Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Timothy Wiley, who is the author of a trilogy, Revolt of the Rebel Angels, Return of the Rebel Angels, and Confession of a Rebel Angel. I have actually read Revolt of the Rebel Angels and part of Return of the Rebel Angels. So today we're going to do a interview with Timothy introducing the concepts in the trilogy, but maybe not completely going through the entire trilogy since I haven't read it all. But anyway, Timothy is an author, a writer, and a musician who is currently in New Mexico, and he is specializing in the study of non-human intelligences and has a very, very interesting story to tell about what happened 200,000 years ago or so with the Luciferian Rebellion and how that is pertinent to what's happening now. Thanks so much, Timothy, for joining us.
I look forward to getting into this.
Well, great. Would you like to give the audience a little bit of background for yourself and how you became, the voice of explaining the Luciferian Rebellion to the world?
Well, that's a very flattering way of approaching it. I don't think I'm the first to go into it, but I'd like to think that I'm kind of including it in contemporary life in a way that perhaps really needs to be done, because in a sense we're still being affected by it, profoundly affected by it. The whole state of the world in many ways is a result of this angelic rebellion that happened 203,000 years ago, and has kind of rippled down through history and has isolated us as a planet. But you wanted to know a little bit more about where I'm coming from. I was trained as an architect, so I have a fairly sort of rational way of approaching things. Mm-hmm. But then in 1973, I had a near-death experience, one of those very profound ones. I think about 10% of the people who have near-death experiences have, where I was kind of lofted right out, and I met angels and was healed in a situation with, I don't know if it was extraterrestrial or angelic, but what was killing me was completely removed from me. But the most profound thing about that was that, you know, for a very rational person to suddenly realize that, we're living in a far larger frame than we had any idea, and that we're part of a much larger game, if you like, than we acknowledge in our sort of isolated state. So that sort of set me off on a 35-year sort of trip of examining what on earth is going on. I mean, if there are angels and if there are extraterrestrials, and, you know, we're not this isolated little planet, flipping around, and we live and we die and that's it. It's a much, much more complex and wonderful and thrilling situation than that. And really, my books, the first three books in a trilogy that I wanted to write every 10 years, a book that went into what the impact of the invisible world was having on us. The Return of the Rebel Angels is the third of that particular trilogy. But that set me off on another track when I'd finished that particular trilogy, because I'd been contacted ever since I was a baby by an angel who had looked after me during the war in England. When I was a tiny baby and the bombs were dropping on me, she'd take care of me. And I didn't know that for years. So basically this entity, I call her Georgia. I don't know if that's her real name, but that's what I call her. And she has, been at me for the last, probably the last 30 years or so, to work together. And about 4 years ago, we started working on a series that she wanted to write, basically. She's been on the planet for the last 500,000 years, so she's been able to observe all the very different things that happened in prehistory. And this trilogy basically is her if you like, her story of what she's observed, because she wants to know what went wrong, what happened. And she's integrating that. I said to her, well, if you want me to collaborate with you on your story, why don't you collaborate with me on writing my story? So she integrates my story into her story as well, and weaves this sort of this reality, if you like, of how the impact of the 500,000 years that we've basically been as intelligent as we are now, not as obviously as technically proficient, perhaps, although some civilizations were very technically proficient, you know, how a single person, you know, has managed to sort of make it through and make sense of all this. So that's really the basic theme of the Fallen Angel books.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed going back and forth between her story and your story. It was a great way to do that. I actually met my guardian angel in my college dorm room, but I wasn't in a near-death experience, nor was I asleep or on drugs. I just woke up from a nap and saw my guardian angel, who was male, warrior class. And later on, I interviewed Doreen Virtue, and she said, actually, I had two male warrior class guardian angels because I was frequently in danger because I defended the underdog. And that's actually been true through my life. I've been frequently in fairly significant danger. So I just was wondering if your angels are always a different sex than you are, or does it matter? I mean, is there a pattern that you know of?
Well, angels aren't basically, they're not sexual beings. They don't reproduce. But they are gendered. They have kind of a gender preference, if you like.
Right.
My two guardian angels, or companion angels, as I like to call them, are both female. And I have a gay friend of mine who wrote a book with me. His angels were male, for instance. So,
really?
You know, you can't really.
Well, may be a pattern.
It could be, yes.
Yeah.
This could take some analysis. But I think we get the angels we need, you know, if you like.
Yes,
visit, you
that's
know.
True.
As you said, you've been fighting a particular sort of battle. So you get the angels who can support that particular
way of being.
One of my angels, one of the two, is not very talkative, but she helps me with my visual work, because I'm basically a visual artist. So, you know, that's her kind of function. The other angel is very talkative and was very helpful to me, you know, when I was first starting to make contact with guardian angels. Georgia is not a guardian angel. She's a kind of a free-floating angel, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, has a somewhat different perspective than a guardian angel would.
So let's start with the Luciferian Rebellion. Would you like to introduce that concept along with what is in the Urantia book and what it says about the Luciferian Rebellion versus what Georgia told you? Because that's very interesting.
Yes, absolutely. I should say firstly that, you know, I've done a lot of study in ancient religions and philosophers and theologians. And of all the ones I've studied, I found that the Urantia book was most resonant to me. It seemed to make sense in a way that a lot of the other ones don't. So I do recommend the book. It's quite a substantial book and quite a substantial
read. It is very long and quite interesting to read. I've read parts of it.
Absolutely fascinating, of course. So what they really go into, if you like, is this rebellion that happened, as I say, 203,000 years ago in the, can't really say capital planet, but the planet that takes care of this particular section of the universe. Right? The universe is divided up into these various different segments. And the smallest basic segment is a local system, if you like. It's a system of 1,000 inhabited or to be inhabited planets. Right? So we're in the system of these 1,000 planets. And the rebellion happened within the system. Now, this system is one of hundreds of systems. So it wasn't a very sort of universe-wide rebellion. It was pretty local in many ways,
mm-hmm.
but it is very profound, and it has affected us very profoundly, as I say. Only 37 of those 1,000 planets were basically taken over by the rebels, and this is one of those 37 planets.
Mm-hmm.
So when that happened, basically, the central authorities basically didn't want the rebellion to spread outside the system, so they isolated the whole system from the rest of the universe, which is why we have the sense that we're alone and there's nothing else out there. But of course there is, and extraterrestrials have been coming and going a little bit under the radar. But say on a normal planet, one would be aware of one's angels. One would see extraterrestrials coming and going, and there are communication devices that link normal planets and one to another, much in the same way as we have our radio stations. And so, in a sense, we've been kind of isolated and left alone. But the positive aspect of that is that it has grown a very, very powerful and strong soul. Because on a normal planet, of course, it's easy to sort of say, please, angels, help me with this, or that, and of course we have to work things out for ourselves, and this is very much valued in the universe. We're given a great deal of credit, especially after we die. We're told that people come up to us and say, what was it like,
mm-hmm.
So it's really very exciting, and kind of emerging out of the darkness, which is really what we're doing now.
So the Luciferian Rebellion was actually Lucifer's idea. I mean, that was. Would you like to go into actually why the conspiracy part that he felt that he came across, and the details of what his differences were with the administration?
Well, revolutions on this planet are complex enough, but when you put them on an angelic level, of course, it's a very complicated business indeed.
Mm-hmm.
So, why did they rebel? Well,
yeah.
What they say is that they rebelled because there was a demand for a greater freedom of action, freedom of choice, freedom of decision, very much in the same way as what we go through on this planet. With the two sides, in a sense, one being, very conservative and keeping, the old ways going, and the other being, more adventurous and more to do with personal responsibility, if you like. So this is really the conflict, and of course there are many levels to it, because on one level, the conflict was a necessary one, because how do you change, how do you bring new things into a system which has been going for, a quadrillion million years and has been very successful? So a rebellion, in a sense, is probably one of the best ways of introducing novelty into a very staged situation. So there are two aspects to it, from the authorities aspect. Of course, the Lucifer Rebellion was a terrible thing. It shook up everything. It took us away from...
Had to be quarantined, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And from another point of view, of course, it served the universe in that it produced a lot of very tough, creative people.
Mm-hmm. And there is basically... The quarantine, from what I can understand, has to do with this seeming lack of guidance from the celestial beings to the mortal beings, as well as the, the cover-up of the existence of any extraterrestrial life forms. And until we actually get to disclosure... where the enough people realize that was a cover-up, you know, we're still quite, I guess, interfered with or not able to receive information that we should be receiving. Would you say that's kind of what's going on with the quarantine?
Yes, I think that's very well put. I mean, in a sense, it has to be incremental. It has to be a slow affair because it is such an extraordinary, profound thing. After 200,000 years of ignorance, to be suddenly thrust into this enormous frame of reference, it has to be done slowly. I think, from reading the extraterrestrial literature, there was an attempt in the 1950s to, bring it out, to make it more public. But I think that was sat on by the American authorities who said that, no, it is too fast. So I think what seems to me is that the various different extraterrestrial races that have been involved and are interested in the planet, and I'm told there are, I think, probably something over 70 of them at the moment, different races who have a dog in the show, if you like. The decision, I think, was made to contact people individually as opposed to go through the governmental thing. And I think that's probably what has been happening. Because I think the latest thing is, I think 70 or 75% of the American public, believe, if you like, that there is life in the universe. So it is happening slowly. But, of course, it is a very profound jolt. It would change everything, if you like, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Would you like to tell our listening audience about your encounter, I believe this was in England, with your first extraterrestrial, and how what you were worried about at the time? Because I think it's very interesting.
It is, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, it was in England in the early 60s, and I don't know what it was like in America through that period, but we were absolutely convinced that we were going to be bombed out of existence. We had no doubt about it. And the thing is, of course, we knew what bombs did. We lived through that
you
war.
You grew up with them. That's right.
We knew what was going on.
You can imagine it wouldn't take too many nuclear bombs to wipe England off the map.
No, it would not. Absolutely. So I was on my way to my college, walking down the street, and a young man was walking towards me, and I didn't kind of really notice him or really think him anything special. And we approached each other on the pavement, and we did that little dance that, do you go to the left, do you go to the right, do you go to the left? And while we were doing that, he looked at me right in the eye, and he said, "We can pick the rockets out of the sky just like that." And he kicked his fingers and walked off. And in that moment, I had the complete conviction that I'd met my first extraterrestrial, and that what he said, he picked the thoughts out of my head, and what he said was, it really changed me. I mean, it gave me such a profound feeling that we were being cared for.
Yeah.
Of course, it was
an extraordinary,
unreasonable thing to think. But then, in the 90s, I think, the American armed services started revealing that, there'd been ETs over their silos, switching the mechanisms off and everything like that. So I felt very validated by that. But what an interesting introduction to happen, I think, when I was 23 or something like that.
it's fascinating. I was reading something in one of the Christian internet sites, kind of a journalistic site, and in it they were interviewing a gentleman who was in charge of nuclear testing for the United States, and he was saying that the U.S. had not been able to do nuclear testing because every time they tried to do it, this would be underground testing, their electronics would get fried completely, So this, along with some other information we've gotten in session, We're of the opinion that perhaps, you know, the reason the North Koreans haven't been able to test anything is similar, and it may be that nobody on Earth has, for a little while at least, has been able to actually successfully detonate a nuclear weapon. So that's very interesting, that there might be a huge amount of surveillance, extraterrestrial-type surveillance from a high-technology standpoint, preventing any of this from happening. And
yes,
so that really is quite, you know, good in that we don't really have to worry about a massive nuclear exchange through an accident or a misunderstanding, which evidently has almost occurred in the past between the U.S. and Russia. So that's good.
Yes, it is. It's a wonderful thing to know, if you like. It would if it was more generally known. Like, of course, there are forces which would prevent that. But if it's more generally known,
well,
I think there would be much more relaxation.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I the message has been given to many, many groups, as you know, that the situation is under control. And I, for one, choose to believe that it is because of various, you know, bits of evidence here and there. But certainly, from what I know about them, they have the resources to do this. So, and I think they have the, you know, the planets. I don't think we as a human race would be allowed to destroy this planet. I think
of course that not. Would I mean, it's
forbidden.
Like allowing the children, you know, in a
home to burn it down.
Yeah, of course.
Exactly.
But again, it always comes from our sense of isolation. You know, we're part of this much larger frame. In, you know, planets like us, must be, you know, millions of them. And the process of going through this way of, you know, we have to first understand the sun, if you like, the power of the sun, which is basically what we're doing with these atomic and, you know, weapons. Of course, we've taken it in a weaponized direction, but at the same time, you know, we are learning a lot about a lot about the environment. You know, we live it. Now, there's another aspect that occurred to me when you brought up that business of being allowed to, you know, set these things off. You know, we don't. The way our science is jigged at the moment, we really don't have an understanding of the way realities are stacked upon each other.
Right, we don't.
Good, you understand what I'm saying, yeah.
I do.
You know, so the subtle energy realities, of course, are also affected by you know, weapons that we explode here. So
they are.
I think that was one of the strong things that was coming through in the 50s, you know, with the early extraterrestrial interactions where they were going on and on about the atomic weaponry.
Yeah, they. I've interviewed quite a few. You know, Stan Friedman and Stephen Greer and many of the people involved in Disclosure. And there's no question that the majority of the really intense ET activity, especially around the silos, occurred right when we were discovering the weapons. And anytime there's a crisis, there's a huge amount of activity seen. So. We are being watched and guarded against ourselves, I would think.
Yes.
I would hope, because we don't have a lot of wisdom when it comes to nuclear, either power or weapons. We're not real good guardians,
yeah.
As you could see what happened in Russia.
Right. But what is interesting is that there seems to be the right person, it seems to be there at the right time.
It does.
Which is another aspect of it, and I think probably more to do with the angels than to do with the extraterrestrials, but it is interesting how the right person seems to step in at the right time.
Yeah. So you talk about frequency domains in your book. Would you like to expound on that, since you are saying that if we had a nuclear blast in the third dimension, it would affect other frequency domains?
Yes. I mean, it's hard to describe because we really don't, we haven't really developed the words yet to describe it. But the concept of frequency domains, I think, is a very powerful one, in the sense that you know, if you look at the it gets so difficult to try and describe. But getting back to the idea of stacked realities, for instance,
mm-hmm.
you know, if we look at our chakras, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say we have 7 basic chakras. Under normal situations, you know, we're pretty familiar with what they are. But they're also, in a sense, reality domains as well, because the base chakra, if you like, is the reality of the rocks. The second chakra, the reality of the plants. The third chakra, the reality of the animals. The fourth, the reality of the human beings. The fifth, reality of the angels. The sixth, of the archangels. And the seventh, of God. So in a sense, we are actually living in all these 7 realities simultaneously, but we focus on the ones that we need to deal with, if you like. So you could say that America, for instance, at the moment, is focused on the third chakra, which is the power chakra, right? Mm-hmm. How do we handle being a victim? How do we handle being an aggressor? You know, we have to, in a sense, understand these various different ways of being. And then after moving through, you know, being stable enough in our base chakra, having worked out our relationships and in the sexual arena, having worked out our power relationships, having, you know, not abusing our power or not letting ourselves be abused by other people, we can then, in a sense, move openly up to the fourth chakra, which is the balance between the inner and the outer, between what is coming down from the angels to be processed into the physical reality. That's our business, in a sense. We're the link between what is to be and what has been. So that's the basic sort of concept of these various different sort of reality levels. Of course, they go on and on. I think it takes a great deal to get out of just this local universe. So these reality domains are, you know, each in a sense has a whole life forms of its own. Extraterrestrials, for instance, often live in the fifth dimension, the fifth reality,
mm-hmm.
And then they have to downstep through the fourth and into the third in order to be within our awareness. Now, equally, these various different dimensions are subdivided into, you know, smaller sort of segments, if you like. Mm-hmm. So an extraterrestrial in our reality can actually move in and out, so become visible and then become invisible, if you like, as they move into the fourth. So that's how it happens.
So, you know, when we're talking about the Luciferian Rebellion, we're actually talking about something that occurred outside the physical Earth's frequency domain. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And then let's talk a little bit about the relationship of the angels to their mortal. The mortals on the planet are in the third dimension, at least on Earth, and then the angels are in a different frequency domain, but they have a responsibility to the mortals. Can you speak to that a little bit, how that relationship evolved and what that's about and how it looks today?
Yes.
And also talk about the wayfarers, because that's another very interesting group of beings.
The watchers, you mean?
The wayfarers.
I'm not aware of that term.
Oh no! Wait a minute. Georgia is a
watcher, right?
The watcher.
A watcher, right?
Right.
Yes. Well, let's go back to you know, the human condition, if you like, first.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm sure you and your audience are aware, we are indwelt by the God. We're indwelt by the Father God. Right?
Mm-hmm.
In a way that the angels are not. The angels are direct emanations, if you like, of the Mother Spirit. They're not indwelt by God. this is an extraordinary thing, basically, because the distance between God, if you like, and us is absolutely vast. I mean, it is the most extreme. We are, in a sense, you know, the bottom of this intelligence well. But we are, and when I say we, I'm talking about mortals on all, you know, inhabited planets. It's not just us on this planet. Now, the angels basically are, they serve the God inside us. Right. That's why they love and adore us so much. It's not because we're pretty and sweet and lovely people. It's because we're indwelt by this God. Now, the purpose of the human life, basically, is to come to terms with this and to come to know and come to love and be loved by this God that indwells us. The angels serve this God, and obviously they serve us as well. Not everybody has angels with them all the time. You earn your angels, if you like, by the way you are. And ultimately, if we, you know, live the kind of life that our soul desires of us, we do get awarded two angels who, you know, accompany us and take care of us on an ongoing basis. And they accompany us, you know, through our death and through the sort of the discussion that happens after death, and then they accompany us as we ascend as well through the various different levels that that we go through, you know, after death. So the angels are very, are very much part of our lives, but they're also, you know, they're not meant to live our lives for us. So if you know, one can't, you know, give our power over to the angels all the time. They often step back and say, "No, that's your decision. You have to take care of that." But of course, in terms of being in the right place at the right time, the angels are incredibly important in guiding us in that sort of situation. And of course, extraterrestrials have angels too. You know, that's another factor, because the extraterrestrials are what we call the outer worlds, and the angels are from the inner worlds, the inner worlds that we contact through our imagination. So it's a kind of a double whammy, if you like.
Great. And the watchers, what role do they play, like Georgia?
Georgia was an angel who identified with the rebel angels when that happened, and she was permitted to stay on the planet as an observer. She can't really interact with people, or at least hasn't really been able to until recently. She's one of a number. I don't think there are a very large number of watchers, because a lot of the rebel angels were taken off planet and were I wouldn't say imprisoned exactly, but were given the re-education. And what's happening now, and this is really the bones of the series, is that the rebel angels are coming back, but they're being reincarnated, if you like, as human beings. They're not aware of being angels, most of them, but they are aware of being very, very different from normal people. And I think a lot of people listening to this may have had very difficult childhoods, for instance, where they have to, you know, take on a lot of difficulties and a lot of problems in order to basically strengthen the emotional bodies, because angels don't have very strong emotional bodies, and you need a very strong emotional body to live on this planet, because there's so much going on, and there's so much going on in the ethers, you know. So Georgia tells me there are a little over something like 120 million of the rebel angels incarnated as human beings on the planet at this point, and more coming in every day, she says.
And basically, from what I read in the book, the reincarnating rebel angels would have a knowledge of their past lives, or at least an understanding that reincarnation is, you know, a mechanism by which we can return to get certain jobs done here and learn certain lessons.
Yeah.
But you seem to have stated in the books that a large number of people on the planet are not reincarnated. They're what you call first-timers. Is that right?
Yes, that's been my observation. In a sense, I mean, to come to a planet like this, it's pretty difficult. It's not an easy world to develop on. Under normal conditions, one doesn't have to reincarnate. You know, once is enough. But in mm-hmm. terms of the angels themselves who are coming into incarnation, George says it's a bit like trying to squeeze a rainbow into a Coca-Cola bottle. It mm-hmm. takes a number of incarnations to be able to sort of integrate into the human or into the mortal line. So what I've been led to see is that the majority of the people on the planet are first-timers, there are this fairly small minority, but a growing minority of reincarnates. Now, a lot of reincarnates are kind of half aware that, you know, something else is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, with what's happening at the moment with these alternative understandings of the way life developed, you know, we're gradually, you know, starting to fill in, you know, the lacunas, the things that we have been either suppressed or prevented from knowing, or irrelevant in a sense. I mean, how relevant is it to most people that there was a rebellion 200,000 years ago? But it's very relevant to the incarnated rebel angels, of course.
Right, and it's because of what's happening now. I mean, there's energetic changes on the planet that are leading to what I guess we would call the lifting of the rebellion, the lifting of the quarantine.
Yes, exactly. I think the sort of key point was somewhere in the early 80s, 1980s, and that. The rebellion gradually, or the isolation gradually started lifting at that point,
mm-hmm.
although still very subtle, obviously. It's really happening. In terms of galactic terms, of course, it's happening incredibly fast. But for us who are down here, you know, it's taking an awful long time.
So, you know, I've not finished reading Return of the Rebel Angels, but is there some information that you've been given about the mechanism of this lifting of the quarantine? I mean, we hear from other scientists that there's a galactic energy wave coming, from the center of the galaxy through the sun that is changing things and, you know, maybe changing the frequency domain of Earth, you know, having Earth become a fourth density rather than a third. Is this all part of the same mechanism of lifting the quarantine?
Yes, I think it is. I think that, to being part of this very much larger sort of frame than we have accepted, it's hard for us to understand how everything is related, if you like. And the mm-hmm. fact that we're moving into a different zone in terms of the universe and all the things that you were talking about does run parallel, if you like, to this lifting of the rebellion, if you like. I mean, as I said, it is an incremental thing. It's not going to suddenly happen. Although I suspect probably there is going to be a kind of a grand denouement at some point. I call it the great mm-hmm. show. I do think that we are at some, going to, and I can't predict when it's going to happen, but there is going to be some sort of moment of when everybody comes together and says, oh my God, of course, of course, mm-hmm. of course.
Well, after that, do you think we will have more guidance and have a better sense of, well, won't be in the dark so much, we'll have more guidance and more information to go on when we're making decisions?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, I mean, in a sort of galactic sense, you know, this 203,000 years period is a relatively short time. And, you know, I think what they say is we're being swung back into normality, whatever that means. But I assume normality is being aware of angels, being aware of extraterrestrials, being part of, you know, the multiverse, being an operative part of the multiverse, as opposed to, you know, being completely ignorant about it.
Yeah, and we probably will be out from under the, you know, the powers that be and the suppression and the corporate greed and the banking fiascos and, you know, just the whole thing that's been cycling around the planet. And also,
well, yes,
I mean,
you see all that,
the crazy stuff, the Somalian pirates and, you know, all the really insane stuff going on in the planet.
Yeah. Well, you know, the function of a human life, in a sense, is to find out who we are and to find out both how bad we are and how good we are. And I think a lot of the disturbances going on at the moment are created, you know, as a result of being kind of out of the loop, you know. We've had to make up, you know, our own ways of governing ourselves, our own ways of feeding ourselves, our own, you know, we've had to work all this out for ourselves. And, you know, 203,000 years later, you know, we can see what the result is. It's frankly not very good. This isn't the best way to run a planet, quite obviously. But at the same time, we are, you know, a planet of whatever it is, 7 billion individual souls, each of which is coming to terms with their own destiny, each of us is growing in our own ways. And this is an arena, a very rare arena, if you like, if you think of it in terms of a benign universe. It's a rare place where people can really discover how, you know, who they are and how, you know, what happens when you do something that is out of kilter. You don't find that out if you have angels saying, oh, no, don't do that, don't do this.
That's right.
That.
Yeah. Well, like I tell people that if we're only in the fifth dimension, where when we think a thought, it occurs immediately, there's absolutely no way to learn patience because there's no scenario in the fifth dimension to learn patience. But down here, because we have to wait and wait and wait longer and keep waiting, we can learn patience.
Absolutely, yes.
So that's a good example of why we come here, you know.
Yes.
I mean, very evolved souls that I know are often without a great deal of patience. You know, that's something that if they're first-timers down here, they're not necessarily going to be good at because they're used to having things right away. And that doesn't happen here.
Exactly. And that's just one of the things we learn.
That's right. So what else have you learned either from Georgia or from the study of the Urantia books about what we're facing now? I mean, what we're... do you think that each one of us is going to be introduced to the multidimensional worlds on a stepwise process, or do you think there'll be a sudden opening for everybody?
That's a very complicated and a good question. I think a lot of it depends on how the incarnation of the rebel angels develops. Because I think that as long as rebel angels need to understand themselves, if you like, which they do as, you know, incarnating as mortals, that we're going to probably continue to need the situation as it is. Now, obviously, in many ways, it is gradually getting better. You know, I mean, if one tunes in on the news, for obvious reasons, you know, they play the most dramatic things they can. But if you tune in to a deeper level, there is something happening on a very deep level that is changing us. And I think we all know this, and we can all feel it happening. It's kind of an interesting thing. There have only been two other rebellions in this local universe before us, so they're probably not that well understood. And it's kind of difficult to predict exactly where it's going to go. What I do know is that every person, sooner or later, is going to get it, is going to understand it. Now, obviously, most people probably will have to die to this reality in order to wake up to the fact that there are other realities in the way that I did when I had my NDE. But I think there are more and more people, if you like, who are absolutely intrigued in these realms and are drawn to them because I know from, you know, my books continue to sell. So that obviously, you know, is a profound interest starting to well up from the inside. Do I think everybody will be touched? Perhaps that is the great show. You know, I mean, all it would take is one celestial, you know, walking around, and who would be transparently obvious to whatever religion, you know. As being a profound entity. That's really all it would take. But of course, it's not going to really happen like that because it would shortchange us in terms of our own growth. So I think I'm back to the idea that we're all developing as individuals, and that's how we were born and how we die and how we progress as individuals.
Yeah, there was something this week that came out on the news, and we've been debating. We were actually debating it in surgery yesterday. It had to do with Google Moon. Did you know that Google Moon existed? It's kind of interesting. It's like Google Earth, but you can look at the moon. And somebody was looking at the moon, and they found this triangular-shaped structure that had seven lights on it. And obviously not something that you would normally see on the moon. And so we were discussing in surgery yesterday whether or not that was left by the Chinese who were recently on the moon, or whether that is extraterrestrial and is something that the extraterrestrials are doing to kind of spur those along who would, you know, want to understand that we're really probably on the brink of disclosure.
Right. Yes, I would say that if the Chinese had dropped it, they'd be very proud of it, I think.
They would announce it, yeah, maybe so. I don't know which one it is. I have to research it further. But if you Google spacecraft, moon, and extraterrestrial, it'll come up. You can actually see the pictures on Google Earth of it, so you can look for yourself and see what you think it is. But you know, it was indicated in session that there would be more and more not only extraterrestrial encounters, you know, with actual extraterrestrials, but also in day-to-day life. I mean, not necessarily a spacecraft, but just meeting them, but also that things over cities would be seen by millions of people and would be very difficult to deny that they, you know, it was swamp gas or, you know, a weather balloon. I think that's happening now. And it'd be interesting to see how the authorities handle those kind of demonstrations of things outside our perceptual reality, or supposed to be outside our perceptual reality, but are intruding into it. So,
well, things are changing on that. I don't know if you've come across a book that came out in last year called Secret Journey to Planet Serpo.
I read a chapter on it. There was a book, and I read the chapter on that book.
Uh-huh.
It was a summary of it, in other words. Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting stuff indeed.
Because what it does, firstly, you know, apart from the Planet Serpo business, it's probably the best I've come across in terms of a summary of the extraterrestrial impact from the sort of, you know, the turn of the last century.
Mm-hmm.
So that's you know, very important material to get out there. But what struck me was the fact that in the 60s, Kennedy put together this DIA, I think it's called, with the specific intention of letting the information about extraterrestrials out into the public. And that's been sat on for the last 45 or 50 years. And only in the last few years have the people who were part of that organization are now sort of retired and they're saying, hey, you know, this is ridiculous. We need to get the information out there. So this is, I think, the first book that I've come across that writes from that viewpoint of finally sort of letting the information, you know, out. And, of course, it's an absolutely extraordinary and fascinating understanding. One can understand, you know, why the government sort of sat on everything for so long, although, of course, now it's getting a little bit absurd. You know?
They have a lot to cover up, but my first, I guess, you know, I was in the military. I was a major in the Air Force, and I interacted quite a bit with the fighter pilots and the astronauts and the, you know, and the Blue Angels and in all of these different areas. And so I knew from talking with them that there was a lot more out there than we were being told. But I actually had dinner with a group of people with Brian O'Leary, and Brian did a little presentation where he put up on the screen the actual transcript of the first time we land on the moon, which, of course, was not what was broadcast to the world. And it was obvious that, there were roads, there were debris, there were, you know, there was a lot of indication that other ETs had been on the moon before us, you know.
Yeah.
Certainly, we were not the first on the moon. So that was kind of interesting to me, that was so...
And didn't they actually, on that first trip, didn't they actually see some craft that was suppressed?
I can't tell you if they saw craft. Later on they did. Both the Russians and the Americans saw the bases. But what they were referring to there were more like roads and, you know, debris, like you'd see out in the desert. You know, it would be obvious if you went to most deserts that there were people there before you, human or not, but people, you know, they left things there, and that's what they were talking about in the transcript, what they were seeing. So but anyway, you know, I mean, I've had there's all sorts of evidence. The fighter pilots would see the craft. I sat alert with the fighter pilots off of in New Orleans, off the Gulf, and whenever they got scrambled, it was either a MiG coming in from Cuba, a low-riding plane with drugs on it, or or a spacecraft that was. I mean, those were the three categories, well known. You know, that's so. You know, I mean, there's a lot being covered up, but of course, in the military, when you're actually flying the F-15s. They know very well that it isn't a MiG and it isn't a regular spacecraft, and it's making maneuvers in the air that no plane on Earth can make. So, and there's probably thousands of reports of that because the fighter pilots all report it. You know, I mean, they have to.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's on their gun camera film. You know, they can record it.
Yeah.
So. There's huge amounts of evidence, and then when you look at the radar evidence, you know, the radar captures all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, we'll see what happens. Well, we're getting close to the end of the hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Yes, my website, which is a fairly deep website, is just timothywiley.com, and Wiley is W-Y-L-L-I-E. W-Y-L-L-I-E. The next book in the series, George's book, books, is coming out later this year. It's called Rebel Angels in Exile. And it's a continuation of her story, you know, through the 500,000 years she's been here. So she's been able to sort of, watch the development of Lemuria and what happened there, and then the development of the various other cultures, Atlantis, and how that, you know, interleaved with Egypt and the Egyptian culture. So, you know, she goes pretty deeply, but obviously she can only report on what she knows, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There are other things going on the planet she has no idea of.
No, she still has a very unique and interesting viewpoint and is quite entertaining in the way she tells her story. So,
I think so.
Well, if you'll send me that book when it comes out, we'll be sure to get you back on. I'd love to continue this conversation. It's very pertinent, at least I feel it's very pertinent to what's going on now. And it helps me understand what many of the other things that otherwise make not too much sense, you know.
I'm so pleased.
It's an important piece of work, and I'd encourage all of the listeners to read the trilogy and then look out for the fourth book coming out.
Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for joining us again. I've been interviewing Timothy Wiley, The Return of the Rebel Angels, Revolt of the Rebel Angels, and Confession of the Rebel Angels. And the name of your fourth book, again, is?
The Rebel Angels in Exile.
Rebel Angels in Exile. Okay. Well, thanks so much for bringing this into, so that we can help understand what's going on. I think that's very important. And thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. And wonderful questions, and very interesting to hear your experiences as well. Thank you so much.
Take care, Timothy.
You too.
This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Next week, we will be interviewing Susan Shumsky, The Power of Auras, Tap into Your Energy Field, and then Saram Singh on the 8th, Your Journey to Enlightenment, and on the 15th, Return of the Golden Age, Ancient History to Our Collective Future. Thank you very much for joining us. This is Dr. Susan Kolb. Join us next week.